You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
April 16th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. Hopefully, broadcasting live from the Wynn Hotel in Las Vegas, Nevada. Sorry, let me take that again, folks. Sam Steeter, we're broadcasting live from the Wynn Hotel in Las Vegas, Nevada. And this is, of course, the Majority Report, the four-time award-winning Majority Report. I'm on the road. I'm at the Mass Torts Conference in Las Vegas, Nevada. I've been told my sound levels are better now. As you can see, folks, for those of you who have listened to this program before and have listened to these shows that I do almost twice a year for the past about 3 years, from this Tort Conference in Las Vegas that is in part sponsored by the law firm that Mike Papantonio, my co-host, one of the co-hosts on Ring of Fire Radio, works for. And it's a great opportunity to come here and both for me to talk to lawyers, not on mic, but on mic, about, well, primarily tort law, although in the past and at this conference, I've spoken to the attorney for Rosa Parks. I have spoken to folks like Tom Hartman, a wide range of people who aren't necessarily associated with tort law. And today, my hope is we'll talk to a couple attorneys who are working on cases that I think you'll find interesting. Want to talk to a securities guy, particularly in light of the speech that Elizabeth Warren gave yesterday. I think it was yesterday. April 15th, it was yesterday, at the Levy Institute, which is up, I'm not sure exactly where it is, but it's out of Bard College up near Hudson, New York, so near my old stomping grounds when we lived up there full time. And the Levy Institute is an interesting institute. It is economists who lean significantly to the left. I mean, maybe that's a broad generalization, but some of the more progressive economists that you will see, I think Michael Hudson is associated with the Levy Institute. Wolf, I think, associated with the Levy Institute. I know a lot of the MMT people are at least broadly speaking, associated with that institute. And so Elizabeth Warren gave a big speech there. And it's interesting from a political standpoint to see the dynamics that are involved with that, with obviously with Hillary Clinton now in the race. We will talk about that. We'll also talk later in the program about the fact that you folks have made it possible, and I don't have my applause on this travel thing. I've got to get this thing in order. But you folks have made it possible for us to win our fourth Best Podcast in News and Politics Award in a row. And I picked it up in Las Vegas the other night. We'll talk about that later in the program. But first, I want to welcome to the program Ben Gordon, who is one of these attorneys working on a case. And it was interesting to me for a couple of reasons. One, because of I tend to drink a lot of wine. Two, my sister actually is in the wine business, or at least represents a winery in Italy. Arsenic has been in the news quite a bit lately because, in my case, because of rice. I guess I was just conscious of it because I had a newborn baby over the past couple of years and started to look into formulas. But joining me now is Ben Gordon. Ben, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Ben, you're an attorney with...
I'm with Levin Papantonio, and we were brought into the case by the Berg Simpson firm, who was a firm which was approached by Kevin Hicks at Beverage Grades when they determined that there are these excessive levels of poison in wine. And the reason we got interested is less about the fact that we're lawyers and more about the fact that we are enophiles and wine lovers and wine drinkers. And we figured out that the wines that many of us drink and take for granted as being safe and even having healthful properties that we've all read about and heard about, in some cases are toxic. And so some cases have poisonous levels of arsenic and lead and other things, but especially arsenic. And so we wanted to dig into that deeper. And as we dug, we found out that the responsible winemakers, the quality wines out there who are not adulterating their wines, who are not manipulating their wines and adding a lot to their wines, are making great wine, and it does not have detectable levels of arsenic or trace amounts of organic arsenic. And that's an important distinction here between organic and inorganic arsenic.
All right, let's hold off on that distinction for a moment. Like, how did this attorneys out in California, I presume, or are we talking about California wines? Are we talking about wines across the country?
We're talking about primarily California wines, but wines across the country are impacted. It's just that the bulk of the, pun intended, bulk wines that are affected by the high arsenic levels are from California. And so the case is filed in California with, we have co-counsel Brian Kabatek and Josh Hafner in L.A., where the case is filed, because all of the defendants in the case right now are California interests.
Okay. And so how does one come about, how does one find out that there's arsenic in your wine? I think I'm going to ask that question two ways. One, how does one find out, as in, my producer Michael, who fancies himself quite a wine bar goer, how does he find out if he's drinking a wine that is arsenic? But how did whoever brought this initial case find out?
Yeah, it was sort of fortuitous at the beginning. There's this company, Beverage Grades, composed of Kevin Hicks and others who were wine distributors. They have wine interests themselves, and they set about to test wines to determine, you know, what are the good things and the bad things about different wines, and try to come up with some talking points and some issues for certain customers who were wanting to know what was in different wines. And in doing that, they figured out that many of the wines, it's a small percentage overall, but many of these very cheap wines actually had these high levels of these deleterious impurities like arsenic and lead. And so that then spurred their interest to talk to those wineries and big conglomerates and say, what's up with this? Are you aware of this?
So they were approaching this initially from, like, we want to be able to say there's a certain amount of tannis or, you know, and right. a certain amount of raspberry.
Exactly.
And so they were looking for all the buzzwords.
Find what the good qualities were about the wines and different. And, you know, they were looking at it across the spectrum of what, you know, whether this is a healthful product. Is there good stuff in the wine? Is there bad stuff in the wine? And in doing it, fortuitously, they came upon the fact that there are these high levels of arsenic on some of the wines.
So they approach these various wineries that whose wines they sort of, and I would imagine they were somewhat surprised. They're like, there's arsenic and lead in this?
Yeah.
What do they do? They just approached them and said, like, what's...
They approached them and said, are you aware of this? Have you tested these wines? And where does it come from? And why is there arsenic in the wine? And they were rebuffed at every turn. No one would talk to them. They didn't want to have anything to do with it. And that's when they... Only then did they approach attorneys. Who then? And this is Berg Simpson, Levin Papantonio, and the Cabotec firm in L.A., did independent testing at independent labs that confirmed the same findings.
Wow. And so... who in this instance is, well, let's get to that in a moment in terms of like who the plaintiffs are. So you guys find out that, like, okay, there's these levels of how much arsenic and lead and these other heavy metals. And that's the problem, right? Because these heavy metals, these are stuff that, like, they don't leave your system. You can't wash these things out, right?
It's right. Sort of these like are the things aggregate. That can deposit, can aggregate, can build up in your system and cause health problems over years. So, you know, the levels to get to that are many times normal, safe drinking water limits. The drinking water limit in the state of California is 10 parts per billion. So the state of California has determined that anything above 10 parts per billion of arsenic is considered toxic and is considered a known health hazard. So what we're finding...
Now, let me ask you about how they calculate that, because I'm also thinking back to when I looked into rice, because in my house now... We don't eat brown rice anymore.
Right.
We just get our rice from, like, literally we'll only buy it if it's, like, Thai rice. Because apparently the soil in this country...
Has arsenic
in it from years of being sprayed.
Pesticides, and, herbicides, fungicides, absolutely.
And apparently in rice, runoff. Anyways, I don't know how it works with grapes. In rice, they say because it is it's grown in such watery situations that it actually the arsenic is floating around and the rice just absorbs it, and somehow because brown rice still has the sheath, it has that much more arsenic on it. And so I've, you know, basically we're a little careful with our rice. Is it the case that you have a unsafe level in water, and the idea is also the assumption of how much water you drink, right?
Yeah.
So it's not like you have one glass of that water with that lead and then all of a sudden you've got a problem or arsenic.
Right.
It's the anticipating
it's the cumulative
over time,
okay. bioburden over time.
Okay.
Exactly. And that's one of the things that, you know, the experts are looking at is if you're getting some level of arsenic from various exposures in the air, in the ground, in water, how much more if you're a regular consumer of wine, and by regular consumer there are many people who've thought and believed with good reason and support in the industry that a couple of glasses of wine, you know, modest consumption of wine on a daily basis is a healthful thing,
right,
and a good thing. So those people are adding 40, 50, 60 parts per billion of wine in every glass, I'm sorry, of arsenic in every glass of wine they drink on top of whatever they may be getting in drinking water. And so that's why the idea that, well, you can't impose the drinking water standard on wine is a little fallacious, because the whole goal of that is to keep people from ever consuming more than the 10 parts per billion per day. And so these people are drinking more than that every glass of wine they
drink. The presumption of safety on that standard of water presumes you don't have an alternate source of arsenic.
Precisely.
That you're getting on the side.
On a daily
right?
basis.
Right.
Exactly.
So you're not having, like, arsenic dessert. How for these wineries, how does this happen?
Well, that's really the $64,000 question, and we have retained some of the leading toxicologists, analytical chemists, and epidemiologists in the world, and we're meeting with experts in Napa, actually UC Davis, in a couple of weeks to talk about those issues. But the fact is, that is not necessarily our burden. We want to know it too, but until the industry comes in and helps us figure that out, we don't know definitively where all of it is coming from. There are multiple possible sources. You mentioned one, the ground, the earth. You know, the world is made up of heavy metals, and there is arsenic in the soil. For the most part, that's believed to be organic and the less harmful. None of it's good. It's all poison, but the body can process and handle naturally occurring arsenic differently and better than it can inorganic arsenic, that which comes from man-made sources. So there is a thought that some of it probably comes from runoff, pesticides, fungicides that are used to spray the grapes, because molds, which is a fungus, love, you know, the powdery mildew, the white mildew, and other molds love the grape, the leaves, and the skin of the grapes, but mainly the leaves. Well, the leaves are one of the primary hydration sources and nutrient sources for the grape. So the large surface area of the leaf, we believe, is a potent source for spray, fungicides, and others to absorb into the system of the grape, and then some of that residue then to make its way to the final product. That said, there's much more testing that's going to have to go on to determine exactly where it comes from, because our belief is, and this is conjectural at this point, our belief is, and some winemakers have supported this, that a lot of it's probably not natural, not coming from the land, not coming from the sprays, but actually being added to the finished product, believe it or not.
Wow.
Being added to plonk, crap, bad wine, forgive me, that is undrinkable, that would not be recognizable in wine, so they're having to add things. They're doing something called blue fining and other techniques that add copper sulfate, for example, and a cyanide-based chemical to manipulate the wine or this grape plonk into something that's actually palatable. So they may buy huge vats of it for, you know, a dollar a barrel and turn it into something they can sell for a dollar a bottle by adding these things that take away odoriferous compounds like Brettanomyces, for example, Brett. Sometimes we know a wine is a little bit funky or a little bit moldy. That comes from naturally occurring bacteria and molds, yeast in the product. So sometimes if a wine is over-sulfonated, there's too much sulfur dioxide in it because sulfur is used to preserve and to fight off microbes, but you get that skunky, whiffy smell at the beginning of when you're smelling in the barrel or when you're even in the finished product. Well, that's not very marketable. It's not very palatable. So what they'll do is they'll use this blue fining or other techniques to add copper sulfate or other substances to get rid of those odoriferous compounds to make it smell better and taste better.
That's like the scenario of, wow, you people are, there's something mentally wrong with you people.
Yeah, and the thing is, and I want to make sure I emphasize this point, most responsible winemakers don't do that. Most of their products contain grapes and water and a little bit of sulfur dioxide, because you do have to preserve it. But the sulfur dioxide, unless you're allergic to sulfur compounds, is not a potential, we've looked at that, not a potential source of arsenic. You have to put a certain amount of sulfur in there to preserve it so that it won't turn to vinegar, you know, immediately, right, and oxidize too quickly. But they don't manipulate it in this way because they don't need to, because they're making good wine. And 99% of the winemakers are responsible, and they care about the land, they care about the culture, they care about your health, and we're not attacking them. We like good wine.
Now, what? Tell me about, in terms of, like, where does wine fall in the context of the FDA? I mean, if I pick up a bottle of soda over there, it's going to give me a list of all the ingredients, right? And presumably, this is the list of all the ingredients. And presumably, they have to write those lists down. Does wine have that same obligation?
Well, there is no national standard that governs exactly what the companies have to put on the wine label to tell, other than the standard that says, you know, that this is a substance that is intoxicating, whatever that standard sort of
right, problematic
federal labeling
for pregnant women,
right,
or something
exactly
like that. But
there's,
they don't have to put their ingredients.
Right,
in.
They do not have to say this contains this amount of grape juice, this amount of these kinds of grapes, or these other compounds that have gone into the winemaking process. That there's no federal standard. That's one of the things we're
why
hoping
is that?
To achieve.
Is it because it's liquor?
Well, that's, I think that's a part of a good political question, the way that the industry has evolved over the years, and that you know, that's handled state by state. It's a little different in California, a little different in Washington, a little different in Oregon, and there is no national labeling standard that governs whether or not they have to disclose deleterious impurities that they know about. Because they know, it's easy for them to tell. They all have laboratories. They know what's in the wine. They can easily tell that this has 10, 20, 30, 40 parts per billion, and they can filter it out of the wine if they want to, but that costs money.
How many people around the country are drinking this wine?
Oh, it's millions and millions of people. And people, you know, the marketing over wine and box wine. And, you know, if you look at Fetzer and Sutter Homes and some of the ones that have produced some of the worst wines, they're spending most of their money on marketing and very little of it on actual wine manufacturing.
So part of this could be that they specifically look for land that is a little bit dubious, that other maybe wineries wouldn't purchase to grow their grapes because they know that it could be tainted. part of this could be a function of we make a product that isn't quite wine yet, and so we need to dump a lot of crap in it.
Yeah, I think it's more of the latter. I mean, time will tell in the discovery process. There could be some of each. But the fact is, most of the ones that we found that are the highest levels are wines that buy their juice in bulk. They buy this grape goop from manufacturers who have put it all together from various sources. Much of it, comes from South America, where there is even less regulation. Much of it, we don't know the provenance of the actual juice that's in there. It may be an amalgam of grapes from dozens of different plantings from different places in California and outside of California.
Wow. And so so what happens next? I mean, you go into discovery. Is the idea here that, are they going to change their practices?
Or that's a big part of it. That's our hope.
Some of these wineries out of business on some level?
Well,
are there, could there ever be, is it possible that they have violated any state or federal statutes here?
Yeah, we're looking at whether or not this is viable as a national class. In fact, Michael Berg will be talking here in a little while, and he and Peter and Brian Cavitek and Mike Papantoni are meeting this afternoon to talk about the national implications, because there are some thoughts that there is a thought that there are certain state laws that may have been violated here in addition to Prop 65 in California. But the reason the case has been brought so far as a consumer class in California is because California does have the most stringent laws, the most consumer protective laws in the country on trying to ensure quality in the substances that go
into our bodies.
Because
they're also trying to basically protect their industry, because I would imagine that the vast majority of California winemakers are like, this is bad for us. We're not engaged in this, and that's why it's bad for us, because A, it brings down, it's obviously, you don't want wine to be associated with poison.
Right.
And B, it is, these guys, obviously, the reason why they can put out wine that's this cheap is because
they're cutting corners.
Because they're cutting big corners.
Yeah, and that's one of the things we want to get across to the community and to the small community in Napa and elsewhere in California, is that this is not an indictment of the wine industry as a whole. In fact, most of the responsible winemakers are at a competitive disadvantage because of the conduct of these fringe players that are producing these, thousands and thousands and thousands of cases of really cheap $1, $2, $3, $4, $5 wine per bottle that is offensive and has poison in it. And we want them to at least have to admit that they have not properly screened, or they've adulterated the wines in one way or another. And it, as a very minimum under California law, we believe they're required to warn about that. So consumers have informed consent, and we believe that'll benefit the entire industry.
So by the informed consent, it's like you should just be aware you're drinking more arsenic than is considered healthy.
Obviously, we want to get the arsenic out of the wine. We want to make them stop. At the same time, the law right now at least requires, under California law, and we hope and maybe some federal standards can come out of this, to be responsible and give people the right to know what they're drinking. And that if there are dangerous levels of arsenic that exceed allowable limits, 10 parts per billion or more, that they at least put that on the label so consumers have, informed consent, informed decision.
And where can I go to find out, let's say I wanted to buy my producer, Michael, a bottle of wine and had the highest level of arsenic, just theoretically.
We have a list of them that have been tested so far, and many more will be tested. We've tested well over 1,000 wines, and you can find that at taintedwine.com.
Taintedwine.com
is a list of 1,300 or so of the wines that we tested.
Oh, my God.
And you'll see actually the names and the parts per billion in the different ones. You'll see a lot of the white wines. A lot of it, you'll see, is in these cheaper white wines, Moscatos, Rieslings, and blush wines, or white Zinfandel, which people like to drink because they're kind of, they're fragrant and they're sort of fruit juicy. And, frankly, a lot of them aren't even really wines. They're being passed off as wine, and that's part of what we object to here is people need to know what they're getting, and sometimes you get what you pay for.
So what happens when, one of these brands says, oh, crap, we're on taintedwine.com? I guess if they felt like they didn't deserve to be there, right, their lawyers would be going, great.
Yeah, that's one of the interesting things is the response so far. We've gotten all these different responses where they want to say, well, in Canada, it's 100 parts per billion that's allowed, and this applies to water, so it doesn't matter. It doesn't apply to wine. All those arguments, none of them have said it's not true. None of them has said we don't have more than 10 parts. Why? Because we've had multiple companies test it, and they know it's true.
Right. And so they basically, they're not
they haven't responded to those specific allegations yet. They're trying to distract people and turn.
I like the idea that the response is, well, what's your definition of tainted?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. And, you know, wow. In Canada, we could put that much arsenic in the wine.
That's right. Well, Canadians are much more hardy people. They reserve like I think an entire like half leg just to store their own arsenic.
It'll be interesting to see what comes out of this. I have a feeling we'll see international standards changing. In fact, if you look at many countries, Bangladesh, for example, looked at this many years ago. Bangladesh, it's 10 parts per billion. Europe, it's 10 parts. Some countries, Australia, 7 parts per billion. There are a couple of countries, 5 parts per billion is the max. So the notion that one outlier country, Canada, for whatever reason, probably because they haven't studied the issue like other countries have, says 100 up to 100 parts per billion. It doesn't mean that arsenic is safe. It means that people should try to get it out, and they simply have said that in their country they made the decision that 100 up to 100 parts per billion is something that we think may not be dangerous. Keep in mind, again, many of these wines we found have 50, 60 parts per billion. Right. So every time you drink it, you're getting, by volume, that amount of arsenic.
Now, so here, this is a sort of a broader question, which is also sort of fascinating to me, and it's always something like, you know, watching the process of the way that a class action is sort of developed and the implications it has. Because at this point, you have no clients, right? I mean,
We do have some clients. Okay. It's a consumer class, so we have class representatives, both at the consumer level who have bought these wines and consumed these wines, and we believe...
Like hundreds or thousands?
Well,
we've been approached by
hundreds.
Okay.
We only have retained a handful to be the class representatives.
Okay.
Under class action, you have to have people who, you know, you have to vet those people and ensure that they have bona fide claims and that they adequately and fairly represent the large spectrum of
people. Now, we've talked about this in the context of Halbig versus Burwell, which is a case I always like to bring up just because now I'm like a fetishist of it, of the Supreme Court case dealing with the Affordable Care Act. And theoretically, those plaintiffs had to have been subjected to a subsidy and couldn't opt out of the insurance. So you've got to do that with all these people.
Yeah, under Federal 23 and under the state analogs, you have to prove commonality, typicality, numerosity, adequacy of representation.
Now, is it conceivable that this case never goes to trial? All these guys on the taintedwine.com, they say, we're going out of business, or we're just not going to produce wine here, or
we're going to shake it up. We're talking about big conglomerates.
How much money is involved in
billions,
it for these guys?
Multi-billions of dollars.
Wow.
These companies are producing so much cheap wine that it is staggering to realize their profits are in the billions of dollars, and they're making... Like I say, most responsible winemakers make a few hundred to a few thousand bottles or cases of wine a year. And they're happy with that because it's good quality, and you pay more for it. These companies...
These guys might as well be softer.
Their theory is, you know, volume, high volume, low quality. So quantity over quality instead of what we've all been taught, quality over quantity.
And so for them, it is a business/legal strategy to take as much time as possible to argue about what the definition of tainted is.
Right.
Because every day that goes forward... Where they're still able to sell
thousands of bottles a day to
even ultimately, if they're sitting in their boardrooms right now saying, like, you know, we could end up paying out. Here's where, you know, the numbers from $1 to whatever, I don't know, 300 million, whatever it is, 500 million, somewhere in between there. If we do it on a per day, per bottle basis, it's, you know, certain percentage of our profits. So we got to keep pumping this stuff out.
Right. Well,
until we get into court and we're stopped.
An integral part of this case is to stop them from being able to make the wines that are offensive and that violate the standard. And so that's why we're hoping the state of California will come in and support the lawsuit or endorse the idea that these standards are violative of California law, or these levels violate the California legal standards and are unhealthful to the public, so that we can get an injunction. We want an integral part of the case is injunctive relief to stop them from making the bad wines, or at least to label them in a way, just like with cigarettes, so people know what they're putting into their body, and if they take that risk because they want to buy cheap wine, they take that risk, but at least they know. But we're hoping that this will cause a change in those companies to realize that they can affordably, maybe they have to raise the price of wine a little bit, but they can get these dangerous levels out of their wine if they want to.
Let me ask you this, and it's probably a question I should have been asking, and I know you got to run here, but I should have been asking of every attorney, because I've heard Papp talk about plaintiff's attorneys in two ways. There's basically two types of plaintiffs. Those who really want to help the plaintiffs and those who really, really hate corporations on some level.
Right.
What kind of plaintiff attorney are you? Is that a fair assessment to break them down in those two ways?
I think that's right. I mean, you know, we're all in business, but those of us who do this and have done this for decades want to change the world. You know, maybe we can, maybe we can't, but I believe Mike Papantonio has changed the world in the 25 years that I've worked with him and learned under him. He and I tried breast implant cases, you know, and people thought we were tilting at windmills there, but we changed things. We got the product off the market, and they've had to improve the product. We want to change corporate behavior. There's got to be a watchdog. They can't police themselves. And I think if they're honest in their boardrooms, they admit that. Any company that's making billions of dollars, it's impossible for them to stop the machine and police themselves. So somebody's got to do it. So we don't simply want to make a bunch of fees. Obviously, we're in business to make money. We don't want to just make a bunch of business. Just make this all business and make fees off this case. We want to change their practices and not expose. Look, my daughter, I've been an enophile. I've had a wine store. She drinks wine because she grew up around me drinking wine and, you know, in France and all. I don't want her drinking, you know, the stuff she can afford is this plonk. And I don't want her exposing herself and her children to arsenic. We want to change their practices so that everybody can make an informed decision. And if they do drink $5 bottles of wine, they at least know that it's not dangerous to their health.
Right. Well, good luck to you. And thanks so much for taking the time.
Thanks very much for making the time. This is an important topic.
Ben Gordon. Okay. So there you have it, folks. Now, right now, I know that Michael is somewhere convincing himself that he only drinks the finest of vintages at his wine bar. But you can go. I've loaded it up here. I don't want to freak myself out. I mean, I don't think I drink that cheap of wine. I certainly have at times in my life. I'm looking at the taintedwine.com right now. I'm trying to see. I get like that two buck chuck. I hope is not on there. It doesn't appear to be. Wine Cube Suter Home. That's a big brand. Smoking Loon. I feel like I've had some of that maybe. Oak Leaf. Mogan David. Oh, my God. I think that's a kosher for Passover wine. Oh, man. Corbel. I mean, I recognize that just from Ménage à Trois. I don't think I would ever get involved in something like that to drink. Franzia. Flip Flop. Fisheye. Fetzer. I recognize that name. Cupcake. Corbett Canyon. Cook's. Well, Behringer, that's a big name. Almaden, wow. Wow. So check out taintedwine.com. I guess hopefully Tubac Chuck is not on there because I know I drank a lot of that at one point. So, folks, before tomorrow, well, let me just give you a sense of what's going on for the rest of the day. I mean, I'm hopefully going to be talking to Peter Mouget. He's also associated with the Levin Papantonio firm. It has his own securities division there. He's also, I think, still the head of Piaba, if I'm not mistaken, which is one of the few. There's also this outfit, Better Markets, that seems to deal with more on a political basis. But there are very few ways that lawmakers hear from people who know about securities, who are not on the side of the banks. And I don't know if Mouget is still the head of Piaba, but he was at one point. We will be talking to him tomorrow. We'll be talking to Cenk Uygur live in person, sitting here. And also, I think tomorrow I'm going to be interviewing someone, an attorney, about, just because I want to cover both bases here, okay? We've covered something from Michael and his wine habit. Tomorrow, we may cover somebody who's going to tell us about energy drinks. So Matt will have his opportunity to freak out as well. As longtime listeners of this program know, that every day at noon when we sit down to do the show, Michael opens up a bottle of like Fumé Blanc or a white Zinfandel, and pours himself a glass and has a small cheese plate. And Matt, meanwhile, every day at noon, cracks open a 128-ounce bottle of some type of like speed drink. I don't know what it's called, like Rush or Super Rush, and has a one of those like store-bought coffee cakes that have been wrapped in cellophane for months. And so I think tomorrow we're going to be talking to someone who's working on energy drinks. Some energy drink litigation. So that I've covered both Matt and Michael on my trip out here. I will give you more details about the podcast award. I'm very excited about it. I'll tell you about the... and I have some also exceptional news. It's day one of the conference. We're really sort of day... three-quarters day. Started last night. But I am actually not down in gambling. I am at almost... I think I'm up almost $215. And it's like the new me. I've been reserved at the table. And maybe we'll get... maybe we can get Alex from Social Security Works tomorrow on the program. We'll be chock-a-block. Or maybe even today. David Pakman is around as well. We'll be talking about Cenk Uygur tomorrow. But right now, I'd like to welcome to the program... He has just sat down with me. Peter Mouget, he is an attorney at 11 Papantonio. Are you still head of Piaba?
No, I'm not.
Okay.
I rolled out a couple years ago. I'm still on the board of directors, still real active, still lobbying in D.C., trying to protect investors, but I'm no longer president.
And so Peter, I want to find out what you're working on in particular, but I don't know if you've had an opportunity to hear Senator Warren's speech at the Levy Institute, and she has come out...
Pretty hard,
awesome. Right?
It's awesome. About time.
Tell people a little bit about what you understand that she's saying here.
What I've reviewed is that she went after the DOJ pretty hard about failing to prosecute anyone of any importance. I mean, the prosecutions that we're seeing are dime store cowboys. None of the big guys are going to jail. There's been no major prosecutions. I don't know if you just saw the other day that Fannie and Freddie CEO, that litigation pretty much shut down, and the SEC walked away from that. So that nobody's going to jail, nobody's doing the perp walk, nobody's getting held accountable. The insurance companies are paying the class actions. Current shareholders are paying former shareholders for the settlement. So she went after them pretty hard and said, "You guys got to start prosecuting cases. What are you doing? I mean, it's just a complete black hole."
And she basically said too, she said, Dodd-Frank did something, but she's now, there's a shift here insofar as she's saying this isn't just a function of our lack of statutory authority. This is a function of the statutory authority not being used properly. And so she's not giving up on that notion that we can tighten up these laws and do better in that regard.
The fiduciary duty standard is a perfect example. We've been working on the fiduciary duty standard.
Tell people what this is, because this is the one that always sort of...
It's really fascinating to me that there's... when you go in and get some advice from Joe Blow of Wall Street, there's... two different regulatory kind of schemes or regimens. One is what we call 40 Act, which is investment advisors, and one is the 34 Act, which is FINRA and the SEC that oversees brokers. Now, if you walked into Merrill Lynch, you would never know the guy on the other side. Is he under the 40 Act as an investment advisor, is he a...
There's no way for me to know as a consumer, right?
None. I mean, there's different standards. So the investment advisor standard, the fiduciary standard, means that they have to put your interest first, the investor's interest first, that they can't recommend proprietary funds if it lines their pockets to the extent they could have the same investment that's cheaper and less expensive. But Mr. Broker can, under the suitability rules. That's the argument. So what we're trying to do is push one fiduciary standard for all investment advisors, because you can't tell which hat
right.
they have
Anybody
on.
Who deals essentially with the public, right?
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
Anybody who deals with the retail public...
Give an investment advice.
They should have just, one standard.
Just like I have to, Sam. I mean, it's the same concept.
Right.
If you come to see me in legal advice, I have to put your interest behind mine. You have to be in front of me. I have to put your interest first. In the securities world, depending on which state you're in, which hat you're in, the standards, it's a patchwork. And so, but we started off with talking with Dodd-Frank and Senator Warren. The problem is that Dodd-Frank said, SEC, go figure this out. 5 years ago,
right?
Go start. Here we are, 5 years later, and there's still. I was. We met with the OMB, the White House Committee on Offices and Management and Budgetary, and last week we met with the SEC. I've met with all kinds of representatives in D.C. on these issues over the last 3 years. It's just it's like trying to push water uphill. I mean,
but they're handicapped in a couple of different ways, right? Because every time they contemplate a rule,
mm-hmm.
six guys in suits walk in, they're representing whoever it is, J.P. Morgan, I mean,
right.
or a consortium,
yeah.
and they say, look, yeah. the day you put this to paper is the day we file in what now in the First Circuit, I guess, right? And we basically tie this up for years. And we drain you of your resources, and maybe we'll win. I mean, let me ask you this. And I think since the last time we've talked, which I think was a couple years ago
mm-hmm.
now.
I think it was about a year ago here, I think.
The First Circuit has been fully, I guess, filled in terms of judges, right? For a long time, this D.C. Circuit Court, which dealt with a lot of these SEC changes, mm-hmm. a lot of the Dodd-Frank rules that were trying to be developed, was understaffed. There was about four, I think, judges that hadn't been sat and nominated and confirmed. Now it's a full complement of 11 judges. Has this changed anything at all?
Not really. I mean, the argument that the industry's using through their army of lobbyists is that the costs and expenses will go up to the retail investor if you have these kind of duties and these higher standards of Dodd, all these acts and Dodd-Frank studies and Dodd-Frank get enacted. And I mean, it's ridiculous on its face, and you have some really real world examples. For example, Florida has a great fiduciary duty standard, meaning it doesn't matter which hat you wear, you have a fiduciary standard. So it doesn't matter if you're the broker, it doesn't matter if you're the investment advisor, you have the same standard. Costs to invest in Florida aren't any more than they are anywhere else.
Right.
Smaller investors still have access to the markets. Retail investors still have access. It's not more expensive in Florida because we have a state scheme that has a higher fiduciary standard. So I think, you know, as far as the bench goes, and legislating from the bench and trying to get some of this stuff passed, I don't even think we're not even close to there yet.
Right.
We don't even have proposed language in most of this stuff yet, Sam.
Wow.
I mean, we're still kicking around
now,
ideas.
Why is that?
I think the, and this goes back to what we started talking about initially, was Senator Warren. SEC is so understaffed, so under 4,500 employees at the SEC to manage 25,000 members. They're so understaffed. They're so undermanned. They're always a day late and a dollar short. Wall Street's always ahead of them. And
And what percentage of those are looking for jobs in Wall Street?
The revolving door issue is always an ongoing. I've been a it's disgusting. I mean, look at Holder. Holder's going back to the private sector
right.
again. I mean, it's from the private. So I mean, essentially, what you're saying is you got regulatory attorneys going to work for Wall Street, and so you know. you're sitting on the same side of the table 1 week, and then the next week you're sitting on the other side of the table. Are you going to go try to put the person that was on the same side of the table as you in jail?
Right.
It doesn't make any sense. So this whole incestuous kind of web of the revolving door, that things just aren't getting pushed, it's business as usual, nobody's going to jail. I've been doing this for 15 years, and it is the same story. It's like Groundhog Day. Wow. It's absolutely amazing. It's disgusting, to be honest with you. And at the end of the day, the main street's the one that shoulders the conflict, shoulders the greed, shoulders the losses, while Wall Street winds their pockets. It's the same story.
Do you guys get heartened by sort of the rise of Elizabeth Warren's political power? I mean, it's interesting, to read about this speech, and then Clinton has come out, I guess, and praised Warren in Time magazine. You see you start to see the political dynamic that's developing here. It's Elizabeth Warren has a lot of leverage,
power.
And you really can see too why she was so adamant about not running for president.
Right.
Because if she ran for president, we wouldn't be seeing this dynamic.
Right.
And now I guess conceivably Hillary Clinton becomes president. She doesn't necessarily have to have the same dynamic with Elizabeth Warren, but I don't see why that would be the case.
Right.
I mean, you're seeing it right now play out where because Hillary Clinton wants something and Elizabeth Warren doesn't, basically, or is just sort of like pushing for wants something but is doing it, is trying to take something on some level. It is sort of bending. You can almost just see the political narrative in that way. Is that something that you notice, I mean, when you go up there and deal with these people?
I do. I mean, she does, use the word leverage, power. It's she is defining the story. I mean, she is setting the parameters. What we're talking about, the issues, she's pushing it. But the problem is she's a lone voice,
right,
in a sea of, and it's just so much money, Sam. It's just so much power. Wall Street drives such a big stick, and we send five lobbyists up there. We send 50 lawyers meeting with representatives. They have hundreds. And the stories don't make any sense. But at the end of the day, she is defining the space. She is defining the story, and it's a great lead to follow. But I do feel it. But at the end of the day, like I said, it's like pushing water uphill. We're not making enough progress.
What cases are you working on now that are particularly new, or do you anticipate seeing more of in the future?
I've got a great story that I wanted to tell you about with the Alabama Supreme Court. I tried a case in arbitration. As you probably know, to be an investor, invest in any firm, about 98% of the firms, 98% of Wall Street firms require that you sign an arbitration agreement. So you're required, you give up your right to a jury, which I think is part of the problem here, and you're
stuck. And that's a much bigger problem outside of...
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
There's no kind of stick or mechanism to enforce your statutory rights because you're in arbitration, and this is a great example why. We tried this case, and I won six in a row. Attorney's fees, full damages, costs. We even got sanctions in one case. Just great results for our clients against Regions Bank, Morgan Keegan, on these collateralized debt obligations. The seventh case, Sam, we lost. Couldn't figure it out. And we represented the Workers' Compensation Fund, state of Alabama. It's every city employee in the state of Alabama that picks up your trash, that works on the streets. We represented. Took the case, got zeroed. Absolutely, it made no sense. I thought we killed him. I was trying to prepare myself not to get an eight-figure verdict. And we ended up getting zeroed. I couldn't figure out why. So I unleashed a team of lawyers, investigators, and what we found out was absolutely disgusting. One of the cornerstones in FINRA arbitration is that the arbitrators...
Tell people what FINRA is.
FINRA is the self-regulatory body. So it's the fox guard, the proverbial fox guard in the hen house. So FINRA is the securities industry that regulates itself and runs an arbitration form. All right? So
that's convenient.
Oh, it is. It's like, if you want to sue your lawyer, you have to go in front of a the bar to try your case.
Right.
So at the end of the day, We're in FINRA arbitration. Cornerstone of FINRA arbitration has to be arbitrator disclosure. So in order, when we pick arbitrators, we get to rank them and strike them. They give us all their background. They tell us where they worked, what kind of business they're in. Well, one of we had a problem with two arbitrators, and the facts were absolutely disgusting. One of the arbitrators was a co-underwriter, meaning they took securities public with my defendant. In my case, this was a small boutique firm, 300 employees. This guy was a partner. No way this guy didn't know. They were co-underwriters with my defendant 36 times on the same kinds of securities that we were arguing about. They were co-defendants 3 times with my same defendant in my case on the same securities. The law firm that was defending Regions Morgan Keegan in our case was their lawyer that took some of their deals public. So the defense lawyers in my case represented this arbitrator's firm that he was a partner in with 300 employees, didn't tell us any of that stuff.
So wait, he didn't disclose this before the arbitration?
That's right.
So according to the FINRA regulations, you're allowed to say, like, hey, I don't want Joe Stevenson's here.
Absolutely.
Ah, here's a list of every time he's been involved. I don't understand. Like,
it's crazy. It gets better. The chairman of the panel had been sued for fiduciary duty while our case was ongoing. Didn't tell us our case was entire, that whole fiduciary standard we were talking about earlier, our case was entirely premised on fiduciary duty. My arbitrator was defending a suit, a fiduciary duty suit, while our case was pending. I never knew it. In closing arguments, I mentioned the words fiduciary duty 32 times in closing argument. My chairman had been sued for fiduciary duty while the case was going on. Had no idea it was pending.
And fiduciary duty, and that's relevant because if your case comes out one way, it becomes at least part of a precedent, perhaps, or some piece of evidence in another case.
It's something that I should know when we're picking arbitrators. Absolutely. We should know.
I understand.
The Alabama Supreme Court, the right as you can get, Alabama Supreme Court vacated, overturned the defense verdict, and we get to try it again. That just happened a week ago.
Congratulations.
Thank you. We're real excited.
But let me ask you this. Okay, and that's great.
Of course,
and
it's great.
It's surprising, too, because that Alabama Supreme Court is sort of like famously... I guess it must have been just like...
Keep in mind, Regions Bank's based out of Birmingham. So the fact that the Alabama Supreme Court overturned one of the largest...
It's pretty egregious.
Oh, it's unbelievable.
But let me ask you this. Like, what is... And this is a broader, like, sort of more general question that seems to come up all the time. What are these guys thinking in their minds? Like... Do they actually think that nobody's ever going to find out
that
the guy was a co-defendant with the people sitting across the table with him?
I have no earthly idea. I thought we killed him. And I have no earthly idea what they were thinking. And it just disgusted me. The people of Alabama have now spent $500,000 trying a case just on costs. They got to retry it.
Well, all right, let me ask you this. I mean, is this a function of... Because, look, and this is the thing that I've come to understand over the years. Is this a function of the fact that Levin Papantonio firm, and there's other firms here of like equal size.
Right.
Levin Papantonio is a big firm. It's highly capitalized. I know there's a lot of money. And what I've also realized too by like sort of going through this exposition hall is that there are basically, I don't know if what you would call them, lenders here.
Right.
Or almost venture capitalists who will say, like, you know, tell us about your cases. We will provide the operating capital you need to try this over 2 or 3 years.
Right.
Because I think this is something that lay people don't understand what the dynamic is here. The reason why corporations sort of come out ahead in so many of these situations is because they have a tremendous amount of cash. They have a tremendous amount of resources. They have their own law firm built into their company whose job it is just to make sure that any type of legal challenges come their way. They just pound them. They come in every day. It's not about even necessarily their jobs are not reliant upon them winning. It's just them stretching it out. It's always a war of attrition. And when I hear a story like the one you just said, it just leads me to believe that they think that they can get away with this type of stuff whether it's a corporation involved in malfeasance or whether it's in this situation, like, yeah, I'll sit on the arbitration, even though it is like quite obvious, is because they don't think they're going to get found out, or they think that they have more resources.
Well,
and like when you guys come in, you have the resources.
We had the lawyers
like,
to go head to head.
You can go
Absolutely.
And walk out of the room and say, hey, you know what? I don't know why we lost that case. You can actually put five junior partners in.
We had that.
In
we have a team of investigators. Right. I put lawyers on it. But you're right. 99% of the law firms in the country, the plaintiffs firm in the country, couldn't afford to do what we did. This would never have been found out. This would have been everybody's dirty little secret.
Right.
The employees of the state of Alabama and the cities, the guys that pick up our trash, would have been screwed. Nobody would have ever
right.
been
and
the
wiser.
And
this is a story we should also tell people. This story of municipal pensions, of state pensions, this is a story that's going on all across the country. I mean, these are the people who really got screwed in the 2008.
This is a workers' comp fund. Right. If you get hurt taking and picking up your trash or cleaning the streets or whatever you're doing for whatever city, you get hurt. This is what takes care of you.
Right.
They just stole money out of it. We tried a case in front of guys that had all these incestuous relationships, but for the fact that I had the resources to go figure it out, nobody would have known. And it just the story's just key, and it's just we go back to it's just the power, the money. The lobby, the force, and at the end of the day, it's going to take somebody to stand up and put some people in jail, hold some people accountable. Individuals, not companies. That's the problem. No individuals are ever held liable at these big firms.
Right.
And they take the money, they pocket it, they move on to the next project, the next synthetic structure, the next synthetic security. It's next to the next dance. The SEC's always behind. And people are walking away. I mean, have you ever checked to see who's buying these $40 and $50 and $60 million condos and penthouses and down? Every time I go to New York, it cracks me up to look at the real estate prices. Who's buying this crap?
It's
Wall Street guys.
I mean,
hundreds of millions of dollars for a penthouse. For a 2,000, 3,000 square foot penthouse on Central Park.
Yeah,
the numbers are crazy.
Really crazy. Well, Peter Mouget, always a pleasure talking to you. Let's do it again. Hopefully, either maybe in October when I'm back, or next April, or if you've got a good case, obviously, you know.
Thanks a lot, Sam. I appreciate it.
Thanks so
All
much.
All right,
for
take care.
By. And folks, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to go into the fun half. Hopefully, I'll have some time for some phone calls. But we also have David Pakman who's going to be joining me. David Pakman, who decided to leave the tables early last night before I went on my hot streak. But his loss, ladies and gentlemen, his loss. I'm going to try and set up a phone situation here. I had one little problem this morning in setting up, but for the most part, I think we're sounding pretty good. And I have not had my... I feel like I'm going to probably add like an extra week to my life because I did not have my normal tech problem freak out. At one point, it was clear that Michael was, I don't know, taking some type of bubble bath before the show. He was just too caught up in his pre-show ritual of wine and cheese. And I'm IMing him, and I'm like, where are you guys? And Michael, of course, responds like, have you not been getting these IMs I'm sending you? Like, pretending like he's been IMing me. And this is a perfect exchange. 11:15, because I'm looking at my IMs. I'm saying this to Pakman now, but I'm going to embarrass Michael because it was the classic Michael. At 11:15, I'm like, hey, are you on Gmail? What IM client are you using? Because I couldn't double up. Not hearing from him. And at 11:49, I'm like, guys, what the F? I need you on your computer. It's 15 minutes before we start. Particularly when I'm on the road, because I need to test stuff. I need to find out what's going on. How's the sound? And then 10 minutes later, Michael comes on. Yo, are these not coming through? And pretending that he's been IMing me. And so I'm like, which things are not coming through? Send me the message that you just sent and the timestamp for what you're talking about. And he just wrote back, 11:59. He gave me the timestamp of at that moment, 1 minute before the show. And he writes, the music is good. So, he said, don't forget to mention the meditating and yoga that he does, the pre-show meditating and yoga that Michael does. I wonder if your yoga instructor understands that you're half in the bag from Fumé Blanc when you come in there, Michael. But Michael was getting a pedicure before the show, so he couldn't make it. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, David Pakman will be here to talk about the Majority Report winning its fourth podcast award in a row. And I got to say, well, I'll have more to say about the award ceremony, which was sort of, I don't know, it was all right. But tomorrow on the program, we're going to be talking at least to one or two other lawyers. We'll be talking to Cenk Uygur of the Young Turks program. He's here. He's getting an award. Oh, yes, we're also going to be talking about the fifth anniversary of the BP settlement. And you should know that I think it was 3 years ago now, 2 years ago. This is not the fifth year of the BP settlement. This is the fifth year of the BP disaster. And the settlement happened, was it last year or 2 years ago? I think it was last year. It was either last year or 2 years ago. And it happened while we were here at this conference. It was either here, it was either in the April version or the October one, and I had the opportunity to sit down with one of the five guys who sat on the committee that developed that settlement. And we will talk to an attorney from Levin Papantonio, and I don't know if it was he the one who sat on the committee. Brian sat on that committee, and so we will talk to him again to get a sense of what's happened since then. Aside from them just running a million commercials on MSNBC saying how we're shocked at how well the ecosystem in under the water seems to have rebounded. We thought it would take it forever, and it's already perfectly clean. But that doesn't take away from our deep, deep dedication to making sure that the environment is fine. My God, I vomit in my mouth. All right, yeah, when we're going to take a break, when we come back, I'm going to talk about a lot of different things that have made me vomit in my mouth over the past day or two. I watched MSNBC. I was watching, God. And I'm going to explain to you folks, and you know what? Maybe if we can get Alex here from Social Security Works, we can talk.
Coming in 10 minutes.
Okay, great. We can talk to him about Chris Christie. Because Chris Christie was out there talking about means testing on Social Security, and of course raising the age of retirement, and those politically savvy, your first reaction would be, hey, wait a second, means testing, all of the people that he's going after are wealthy, won't they be pissed about that? They're not going to get their Social Security if they're making over $200,000. And you'd also be saying, like, wait a second. All the people in the Republican primary, they're old. They're all the oldies. Why would he be talking? Why would he come out of the gate and talk about Social Security reform? I will answer the question for you, either with or without Alex, because because that's just the way I roll. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with the better half in just a moment.